Hangbuster. National program that brings you authentic police case histories has asked John J. Sullivan, retired, former deputy commissioner and chief of detectives, New York Police Department, to narrate by proxy tonight's case. Commissioner Sullivan.
There's been a good deal in the newspapers recently about wiretaps, Gangbusters listeners. Tonight's case deals with an official telephone tap granted by the courts to enable the police to fulfill a function as important as the solution to a crime, which is the prevention of one. It began in New York City late one summer afternoon when Detectives Lawrence Barton and Frederick Dorsett, attached to an outlying precinct, were walking along a street in the Upper Bronx following their tour of duty.
Hey, Larry.
What?
The fellow that just got off that bus.
The tall man, Fred?
No, the guy in the lumber jacket walking just ahead of him.
Yeah?
Well, wasn't he in the lineup when we covered it last week?
Well, I can't tell. Can't get a good look at his face.
Heavy features. Big nose, wide set eyes.
Maybe that traffic light will hold him.
What do you think, Larry?
Yeah. He's a burglary suspect. Long record, 3 or 4 convictions. Can't remember his name.
Wasn't he on parole?
I don't quite recall, Fred.
Well, if he is, he's breaking it. He's going into that bar.
Feel like a beer, Freddy?
Yeah. Beer might taste good at that.
In following the known lawbreaker into the bar, Gangbusters listeners, Detectives Fred Dawson and Larry Barton were following good police procedure. Criminals are seldom lone wolves, and it is important to establish and identify the places in which they meet to plan their crimes. The man they'd seen in the lineup was ordering a drink as Dorsett and Barton took their positions a few feet from him.
What'll it be for you, fellas?
Beer.
Same, please.
Yeah. George, speaking in.
Just went down to the corner to get a paper.
Has he heard from, you know?
I don't think so.
When it comes in, tell him I'm in the back booth.
Okay.
My bartender.
2 more?
Yeah. You got another phone? I see that one's out of order.
Yeah, there's one in the rear.
Thanks.
All right, Biggie.
Gus show up, Joe?
He's in back, Biggie.
You don't know of any jobs around, do you, bartender? My friend and me are new here in town.
Huh? What's your line?
Oh, I'm not particular. Just so long as it pays.
I haven't heard of anything. Excuse me, I have to come through the bar right under here to get to the phone.
Sure.
Hello? Yeah, hang on. Gus?
Yeah.
For you.
Hello? This is Gus. Well, we should have been waiting for you. Biggie and me got something.
I thought the sign said the phone was out of order, bartender.
There must have been some at the phone exchange or something. I guess they fixed it.
Okay. I can't talk to Biggie about it. We'll give you a call. Probably take a day or two. Sure. Yes, so long.
Want me to take the out-of-order sign down for you, bartender?
No.
No?
Well, what's the difference? There's another phone in the joint. This keeps the line open in case someone wants to call in.
A few minutes later, Detectives Dorsett and Barton left the Bronx bar. But instead of separating and going to their respective homes, they went by subway to the Bureau of Criminal Identification at Center Street in downtown Manhattan. There, while Fred Dorsett checked the mug file, Larry Barton checked the alias file.
Got him yet, Fred?
Yeah. He's on parole, all right. Gus Sickle. 9 arrests, 3 convictions. All burglary and robbery. You find anything?
There's one biggie in the alias file. A man named Albert Toler. Here's a card.
Well, there. Larry, you can't say Albert Biggie Toler hasn't devoted his life to his work. 1948, robbery. Suspended sentence. 1949, robbery. Drew 2 years. 1951, mugging suspect. Couldn't make it stick. 5 more.
They're casing a job, Freddie.
Yeah, they sure are.
You think they want the third guy in, whoever he is?
It figures.
It'd be nice to get a good arrest on these guys, wouldn't it? One where we got them cold and there's no way they can get out of it?
Yeah. 17 arrests between them, only 4 convictions. Would be kind of helpful to get a good arrest on these bums.
Gangbusters listeners, there's something you must understand about policemen. When an officer makes an arrest, he must be sure it's a proper one. This is a safeguard set up by our Constitution and one we must protect. A check with Gus Sickle's parole officer revealed that Sickle was working as a mechanic's helper in a garage. And the next morning, Detectives Dorsett and Barton met with Lieutenant Richard Jackson, commanding officer of their squad.
Sickle and Toler are using this bar as a hangout, Lieutenant. They've got an out-of-order sign at one of the public phone booths. The phone works.
That's right, Lieutenant. Gus Sickle received a call on it. He expected it.
You better get back in there, boys. But you better make it look good.
Oh, I did the talking before, Lieutenant.
What'd you say?
No one in town looking for a job, that sort of thing. Same for Larry.
Fred took the lead, Lieutenant. I let him go.
Well, that sounds all right. Fred, supposing you go back, be complaining about the fact that your pal has got onto a job that you still haven't. You're willing to try anything. Maybe if you hang around enough, buy a few drinks, so you're running out of money, as long as you got it, you spend. Easy come, easy go, you know. You might be able to learn something.
Could I draw some money for that, Lieutenant? If I bought drinks, Florence would kill me.
Yeah, I guess I could get you $25 for that, Fred.
Hi. Give me a beer, will you?
Sure.
Here you are.
Thanks.
What do you know about that, Philip? Remember yesterday afternoon? I was in here with this friend of mine?
Sure, I remember.
This friend of mine bumps into a guy looking for ice cream salesman to drive those little trucks around. My buddy's working. Today, I go over to see the man. Jobs are all filled up. How are you going to figure it?
It's hard to figure, all right.
Yeah. My name's Fred. Your name's Joe, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I sure would like to get situated someplace.
Joe.
Sure, Gus. Same as usual?
Best of beer.
How's about having a shot with me, buddy? Give him a shot, Joe. Take it out of the change.
Just a beer, Joe.
But no offense. I was standing here. There's no harm offering to buy a drink. Name's Fred. Fred Dorsett.
Wasn't you in here with another fellow yesterday? Big guy?
Yeah. That was my pal. We come down from
upstate. Why don't you wait for your pal to come in, Fred? Maybe you can buy him a drink.
Give me a couple of dives for the phone, Joe.
Jesus.
Not very friendly, is he?
No, they're not very friendly, dear.
Well, I guess I'll make a call.
Now, why don't you do that, buddy? Somebody that'll shoot the breeze with you. Someplace else.
Detective Dorsett made a telephone call from the second public phone in the bar, making a mental note of its number as he did. Then he returned at once to his precinct squad room, where he, Detective Barton, and Lieutenant Jackson discussed their next step.
I think I've blown it, Lieutenant. We might stake out a new man in a bar, but he'll have a rough time getting close to Gus Sickle.
Well, what if you put a tail on him, Lieutenant? If they're still casing a job, we can at least pin down its location.
It can't be either of you boys, though.
If Sickle gets another look at me, we blow it for good.
Lieutenant, it would be real good to grab these guys right.
You're a good tail, Lieutenant.
Never known you to lose a man.
Why, there are half a dozen guys in this squad. Okay.
Okay, you think Sickle's still at the bar, Fred?
He's probably waiting for Biggie. Biggie hadn't come in when I left.
All right, I got my Chevy. Let's see if you can connect me with him, huh?
10 minutes later, gangbusters listened. Lieutenant Jackson's black sedan moved slowly by the entrance to the Bronx bar.
Is Sickle still there, Fred?
Just a minute. Biggie's there now. I don't see Sickle.
Okay, we'll park.
Lieutenant Jackson parked his car so that he and Detective Dorsett sat with their backs to the saloon entrance. Then, for a moment, he adjusted a large rear-view mirror. For 20 minutes, the two detectives sat, gangbusters listeners. To a casual passerby, they were two salesmen discussing a deal. A more alert person might have noticed that the smaller of the two salesmen, however, never took his eyes from the rear-view mirror until...
Okay, Lieutenant. It's both of them.
Which way they're headed, Fred? This way past us?
They're making up their minds. Yeah. Sickle's the big nose fellow, wearing that tan windbreaker.
Oh, they're hopping that bus up the street, Fred.
Shall I stay behind it?
Keep in the right-hand lane. The traffic will make you stay behind it.
Yes. Moving down to the front of the bus, Lieutenant. About to get off, I think.
Okay, get ahead of it. Right along here, Fred. Take the car back to the station, Fred.
Yes, sir.
You and Larry wait for me there.
Yes, sir. Good luck.
Within minutes after it had alighted from the car, Detective Lieutenant Jackson was certain the two hoodlums were planning a stick-up. They left the bus at a busy intersection in Manhattan. For the better part of an hour, they loitered along the block, paying particular attention to the actions of the clerks in a giant supermarket and the movements of the uniformed patrolman on post. Each entered the supermarket separately, taking a long time to make small purchases. Finally, the two burglars again boarded a bus and returned to the Bronx Tavern. When Lieutenant Jackson entered, Biggie Toller was waiting at the bar, and Gus Sickle was in the phone booth, marked out of order.
What do you have, mister?
Give me a large shell of beer.
Right.
We look into it. Goodbye. What do you think of that, Biggie?
Single warning. On the phone, he told me. He don't like the fella. Don't like nothing about it. He's got a brand new idea.
Right down, guy. After all that work, he says no.
So he says no. We got to have him or we got nothing. Hey, Jones.
Yeah, Biggie?
Throw a couple of beers over the back booth, will you?
Hey, right away. You want us to throw you another, mister?
No, thanks. I got to get him along.
Lieutenant. That was fast.
Yeah, fast and bad.
You lose them, Lieutenant?
No, Larry, I didn't lose them, but they lost the job. They made another case of the heist. It was that big supermarket there at 125th, Fred.
Huh.
Then they went back to the saloon and Sickle called the third man.
He must be pretty important.
Well, we need him. They aren't going to move without him. He refused the setup, so they're going to start all over.
We've got enough to get a phone tap order, haven't we, Lieutenant?
I should think so. Fred, write up what we have so far. The two men's arrests and convictions, along with what we know of their movements now. Their use of that phone in the bar. I'll take it to the judge.
Lieutenant Jackson's request for a listening device on the public telephone in the Bronx bar was approved by his commanding officer and granted by a judge after review of the facts as known. The location selected as a listening post was a basement in a building located around the corner from the bar. Technical employees of the telephone company, obeying the court's order, brought lines from the main phone lines under the street, set up a direct tap on outgoing calls from the public phone, a telephone by which the detectives assigned to the listening post could make calls, and a general tap on the trunk line which carried calls to the public phone. This was the equipment with which Lieutenant Jackson and Detectives Dorset and Barton hoped to trap Sickle and Toller and identify the unknown third man. For 48 hours, the men heard little except an occasional lame excuse offered a wife by a tardy husband, or as the bartender gave suppliers. Then, as the reader monitored the trunk line...
You'll get on it this time, Larry.
Sure.
Larry,
Ain't talked about it much yet. You'll handle the car, Joe. Yeah, Merle. Now, this is going to be a real cinch if it works out the way I said it.
That's Merle Flesh.
Yeah, I'll try it. Okay. And you tell Gus or Biggie to call me when they come in.
Well, I think the lieutenant might like to hear about this.
Huh, Larry?
Brother, if that's Merle Clint...
Back to Gangbusters in a moment. Monday night on most of these same CBS radio stations, Mr. Keene, tracer of lost persons, takes on the case of the man who talked too much. When a loquacious inventor spills too many beans about his new invention, death seals his lips, and Mr. Keene is called on to probe the killing. Remember, it's Monday night on most of these stations, Mr. Keene, tracer of lost persons. Remember, too, this Tuesday evening... Suspense brings you a thriller about Mau Mau trouble in Kenya Colony, East Africa. A story titled Lily and the Colonel. That's on Suspense this Tuesday night at the Star's address. And now, back to Gangbusters and Commissioner John J. Sullivan.
There's good reason for Detective Barton's excitement over the possibility that this third man was Merle Clint, Gangbusters listeners. There'd been a flyer out for 2 months issued by the Detroit police. Merle was a convicted murderer. More, an escaped convict. A gunman who for 3 months had dropped completely from sight. Well, within 20 minutes after being notified, Lieutenant Jackson arrived at the wiretap listening post.
Is there anything more, Fred?
It's Merle Clint, all right. The bartender made a call to Gus Sickle. Told him Merle was beginning to holler for action.
Well, that ties it. Clint's probably got a bad case of the shorts.
No dough.
Well, if Clint's in it, Lieutenant, this job will be a big one. He won't take any chances for peanuts.
Yeah.
What did Sickle have to say, Larry?
He said he was coming right in. Wanted to talk to the bartender and Biggie. Then he'd call Clint.
He may have a job case, Fred. Call the precinct. When Sickle places the call, have a trace put on it. We have to find out where Clint is.
Right away, Lieutenant.
That's us. Better pick it up.
Yeah? This is Biggie, Joe. Gus around?
Not yet.
Well, tell him I got tied up. But the guy in the place agrees he'll go along the way we said.
Now, wait a minute, Biggie. Yeah, Gus is coming in now.
Just tell him to call Merle Clint, Joe. I'm coming on in.
Keep the line open, boys. There'll be more. They're setting the deal.
Sure. Hey, here they go.
Yep.
Hello? I got Sickle, Bill. Well, I gotta hand it to you. This job's gonna be a cinch. How about Biggie and me coming out with talk? You don't come within 5 miles of this place, Gus. Been too good a stash for me. You got everything set?
Biggie closes it with this guy works there. As the guy goes out, he slips the plaster over the lock so it don't catch. It's one of those you can open from the inside, not from the outside.
Well, how does the hall look?
Couldn't be better. The joint's running a big clearance, but the shoes are still selling for better than 10 a pair. The place is jumping. Not enough salesmen. They're open till 9 at night. And get this, Merle. 23rd Street is jammed with people leaving the store, but 24th, they got nobody. The rear door goes right out through a little areaway. That's the one we use.
How much, though?
This guy in the store thinks 10, 15 grand with time it right. You need dough, Merle.
Well, okay, set it. Joe drives.
Joe drives.
Yeah.
Well, Larry, we've got got no idea when they're going to pull this.
Yes, sir.
They've got a man inside. We can't take a chance. It might even be the manager.
Yes, sir.
They're having a sale. They need salesmen. It's a big shoe store on 23rd with a rear entrance on 24th. Shouldn't be hard to find.
I wouldn't think so, Lieutenant.
Try to get a job working there, Larry. You better have a gun.
I'll use an armpit holster.
Good.
Hello? Yeah, this is Fred Dorton. Yeah. Yeah, thanks. Lieutenant, they traced that call to Merle Clint.
Where is he?
Rooming house in Queens. He's probably still there. Shall I have him picked up?
I don't know. Larry.
Yes, sir.
You get a job in a shoe store, you may have to face up to Merle Clint.
We'd like to get those guys, Lieutenant.
The two others, Sickle and Toller, they'll have guns.
You guys will be outside, Lieutenant. Maybe when they come out, I'll have sold them a new pair of Brogans each.
Okay, then. We won't pick up Clint, but we'll see if we can't take them all at the same time.
In warfare, gangbusters listeners, what Lieutenant Jackson of the New York City Police was now taking would have been called a calculated risk. But the fight against crime is warfare. Preventive warfare. A watchful day passed. Then, as Lieutenant Jackson again joined Detective Fred Dorsett at the wiretap in the dingy basement.
Hi, Fred.
Hi.
Anything new in the box, sir?
Nothing, Lieutenant.
Well, Larry Barton got the job, Fred. He's now a clerk at the shoe store.
Good.
How's the coffee?
I'll plug it in. Only take a minute to heat up.
Good.
Larry's in the store. I sure hope they make the move. Wait a minute. I'm getting so I know those clicks, listening to them all day. That's not ours.
Larry's given me the setup. At 9, they close the front and back door of the store. The customers go out the front as they finish shopping into 23rd Street.
Mm.
And the clerks check in their sales books with the manager in the rear of the store, give him any final cash transaction, check out, and exit on 24th. That's where the door is, that the lock is being given.
Hey, that's ours.
He has an idea what they're up to. We'll blow it again if we go in and talk to him.
Maybe if I went in to buy some shoes.
It's a lady's shoe store.
Well, if we get one of the gals in the department.
We never get to there in time. We'll just have to hope that Larry doesn't try to stop him. Fred, get on the phone to the captain.
Yeah.
We'll let those bums go into the store, then block off traffic on 24th Street. We'll need two patrol cars, one at each end of the block. I got the commanding officer of the precinct in that area alerted. He can have four men there to help. Okay, you can turn that doodad off. We got work to do.
Some moments later, inside the shoe store, Detective Larry Barton, fully aware of the plans, but not knowing of the timing, was busy acting out his role of shoe salesman.
Well, they're attractive.
And you can't beat them at the price, man.
I just don't know about that shade of red, though. But do you have something a little darker, you know, more of a maroon? Oh,
ma'am, the store is closed. It has been for 10 minutes.
Well, if you had something darker in that style, I'm sure I'd take them.
Well, you see, the management objects to going for new stock after the store's closed. Now, if you'd like to drop it tomorrow...
Well, those men are coming in, Ben. They've got guns.
Quiet, lady. You won't get hurt. Watch that door, Biggie. Just keep these people covered.
Okay. Against the wall there.
Well,
just turn as though you're looking at the stock. No spots and nobody gets killed.
Hey, you. Give me the money. It don't have to be me. Just stuff it in the bag. Okay. Now just keep standing that way until you count to 100. There's going to be a guy watching. The first one moves, gets it. All right, Gus. Okay, Biggie?
Hey, there's something wrong here, Merle. Look in the street. Hasn't been a car or a person moved since we came in.
All right, keep them covered, Gus.
Hey, they know about the job. They got the street blocked.
What are we going to do?
23rd Street. Crowds will keep them from shooting. If anyone gets in the way... Hey, you back.
Hello, police officer. Hit the deck, everybody.
They're making for the front. Stop them.
Larry?
Yeah, Lieutenant.
You all right?
Shoulder, I think. It's numb.
Yeah, don't try to move, boy.
Get him, Lieutenant.
We got him, Larry. We got him good.
Beth Sickle and Albert Biggie Toro, both wounded in the gunfight, were brought to trial and recovery and are now serving maximum sentences. And the city of New York cheerfully surrendered Merle Clint to the Detroit police. In New York, he would have been convicted for armed robbery and assault with intent to kill. But in Michigan, he was already convicted for life.
Thank you, Commissioner John J. Sullivan, retired, of the New York City Police Department. And now, Gangbusters Nationwide Clues, broadcast every week to assist American police in their war against the underworld. Attention, Gangbusters listeners. Maintain vigilance for Patrick Eugene McDermott, a convicted murderer sought by the FBI for unlawful flight to avoid confinement. Listen carefully to his official description.
Patrick McDermott, age 56, 5 feet 4 and 1 half inches, 172 pounds. Brown eyes, sometimes wears glasses. Brown hair, gray. Medium complexion. May work as a hospital technician, machinist, barber, or composer of crossword puzzles.
This fugitive has a 1-inch scar over left eyebrow. Tip of left index finger is amputated. Has tattoo of red and blue bulldog head, right forearm. Has complete set of upper and lower dentures. He is interested in astrology and composes crossword puzzles.
McDermott reportedly carries a snub-nosed revolver in right foot pocket. Consider him dangerous. Attention, all citizens. Be on the lookout for this man wanted by the FBI for unlawful flight to avoid prosecution for the crime of robbery.
Herbert Dennis Bechtel. B-E-C-H-T-E-L. Age 37, 5 feet 7, 175 to 80 pounds, stocky build, brown hair, brown eyes, ruddy complexion. May seek work as a beekeeper or a dairyman.
This man has the following identifying marks: a 2-inch scar on chin, nails on left ring finger marred, 6-inch scar on back of left leg. Ball of left heel amputated, causing limp. He may be wearing mustache and long sideburns, and have hair dyed and artificially waved.
Caution. Bechtel may be armed and has reportedly stated that he will not be taken alive. Consider him extremely dangerous. If you have any information concerning these clues, notify your local police, the nearest office of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, or Gangbusters at once. Tonight's Gangbusters case was written by William L. Stewart and directed by Leonard L. Bass, with Jack Orison, Bill Lipton, and Wendell Holmes in leading roles. This production was supervised for CBS Radio by Jerry Danzig. Art Hanna speaking. To amazing facts in the case of the unusual partners on Gangbusters, a production of CBS Radio in cooperation with Phillips H. Lord.